From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The FCC is poised to announce major revisions of media ownership regulations on June 2nd, and media activists have been organizing against the rollback and redoubling efforts to keep media accountable, fair, and democratic.
Today, we'll look at the FCC and media concentration. But first, the Indonesian military has launched a massive attack on the separatist movement in Aceh. It's expected to be Indonesia's biggest military operation since the invasion of East Timor in 1975. We'll go to Jakarta. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As many as 10,000 Shiite Muslims rallied peacefully in front of a Sunni mosque in Baghdad today to protest the U.S. occupation and the installation of what they view as a U.S. puppet government. It's being called the largest anti-U.S. protests since the invasion. This comes days after the United States announced it has indefinitely put off plans for Iraqi self-rule by an Iraqi National Assembly. Paul Bremer, the new U.S. civil administrator, announced on Friday the U.S. and British officials would remain in charge of Iraq for an indefinite period. At the same time, the U.S. and Britain are pushing the United Nations to lift economic sanctions against Iraq so that proceeds from oil sales could begin financing reconstruction. The Los Angeles Times is reporting hospital records from Baghdad indicate at least 1,700 civilians died in the Iraqi capital during the U.S. invasion. Another 8,000 were injured. As many as 1,000 people are still missing. The Indonesian army has launched a massive attack on separatist rebels in Aceh. Fighter jets bombed the Free Aceh Movement rebels and scores of troops began parachuting in. Some 25,000 Indonesian troops are in the region. Thousands more are moving in. The military says it has moved 15 warships to the region. The Associated Press is reporting the attack is expected to be Indonesia's biggest military operation since the invasion of Timor in 1975. The U.S.-sponsored peace plan between Israel and Palestine took a series of blows in the hours and days following a meeting between the Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and his Palestinian counterpart Mahmoud Abbas. It was the first high-level talks between Israel and Palestinian leaders in nearly 3 years. Sharon has called off a planned visit to Washington. Israel has sealed the borders of the West Bank and Gaza, barring Palestinians from entering Israel. And the isolation of Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat has intensified. Foreign diplomats and visiting politicians will now be barred from meeting with Israeli officials if they intend to meet with Arafat. Arafat has backed the international peace plan, but Israel is blaming him for the upsurge of violence. There have been a total of 5 suicide bombing attacks carried out by Palestinians over the past 3 days, including a simultaneous attack in Jerusalem that killed 9, including 3 bombers. Moroccan officials have arrested more than 30 suspects following a series of suicide bombings on Friday that killed 41 people and injured 100. The targets include a Jewish community center, a busy Spanish restaurant and social club, and the Belgian consulate. Morocco's interior minister said there were similarities between the bombings in Casablanca and Saudi Arabia, in which 34 people died last Tuesday. Officials say the suicide bombers were likely Moroccan who lived in Casablanca's northern slums amid tin shacks and dirt sidewalks. The Washington Post is reporting Saudi authorities are investigating whether members of the country's National Guard illegally sold arms to Al-Qaeda operatives in the country prior to last week's bombings. U.S. and Saudi officials said weapons seized from a May 6th raid on an Al-Qaeda safe house were traced to National Guard stockpiles. Saudi officials say they've arrested four people linked to the bombings in Riyadh. Meanwhile, the Washington Post reports that U.S. officials now suspect a top Al-Qaeda leader who is hiding in Iran helped organize the Saudi bombings. The Post reports the leader, Saif Adel, is one of several top Al-Qaeda leaders who are now in Iran. The same U.S. official said Al-Qaeda now has two key command centers, one along the Afghan-Pakistan border, the other is in Iran. In the Philippines, as many as 60 people have been killed in a military attack on Muslim separatists in the southern region of Mindanao. Following the air attacks, ground forces moved in. Philippine President Gloria Arroyo is scheduled to meet with President Bush at the White House later today. She's expected to seek further military aid in return for Philippines' support. The Los Angeles City Council is drafting a law that will require businesses seeking city contracts to disclose whether they profited from slavery. The law will not require reparations or bar the company, the companies from doing business with Los Angeles. The daring rescue of Jessica Lynch is one of the memorable stories to emerge from the U.S. invasion. According to U.S. Central Command, U.S. Special Forces braved enemy fire and risked their lives to rescue the 19-year-old private trapped behind enemy lines. Several weeks ago, we spoke with Robert Lloyd Perry of the London Times, who first raised questions as to what really happened to Private Jessica Lynch. Well, now the BBC has taken the story a step further. According to a BBC broadcast last night, the entire story was invented to buck up morale and support for the invasion as it got bogged down in its initial advance. According to the report, Lynch received no battle wounds and her rescuers endured no enemy fire. Several Iraqi doctors were interviewed for the report. They said Lynch's care was good considering the war that raged outside. The report alleged the American rescuers knew beforehand they would not come under fire, but staged a daring rescue operation anyway. Dr. Anmar Uday told the BBC the hospital staff was surprised by the helicopter assault. It was like a Hollywood film. They cried, go, 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 with guns and blanks and the sounds of explosions. The assault was filmed by a U.S. military night vision camera. Military officials made an edited version of the film available to the press within hours of the operation. U.S. Command spokesperson Brigadier General Vincent Brooks told reporters some brave souls put their lives on the line to make this happen, loyal to a creed that they know they'll never leave a fallen comrade. We may never know Private Lynch's side of the story. The Pentagon says she suffers from amnesia and can't remember being captured, her stay in the Iraqi hospital, or her rescue.
There's a journey we all take, burdened down with small mistakes, and each one takes us to a higher ground. And the time to make a choice will take you to long ago.
Susan Aglekar, Casualties of War, on the CD, 20 Years of Resistance to Genocide in East Timor. This week, the anniversary, the first anniversary of Timor's independence. This is Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Indonesian army has launched a massive attack on separatist rebels in Aceh. Fighter jets bombed the Free Aceh movement. Rebels and scores of troops began parachuting in. Some 25,000 Indonesian troops are in the region, thousands more moving in. The military says it's moved in 15 warships to the region. The Associated Press is reporting the attack is expected to be Indonesia's biggest military operation since its invasion of East Timor in 1975. After that invasion, the Indonesian military killed a third of the population of Timor, 200,000 people, before it became independent. Last week, peace talks in Tokyo broke down after rebels rejected Jakarta's demands to lay down their weapons, drop their bid for independence, and accept regional autonomy. President Megawati Sukarnoputri then signed a decree authorizing war in the oil and gas-rich province and imposing martial law. The military immediately arrested five senior rebels. December's landmark peace deal is now in tatters. At least 12,000 people have been killed over the last 26 years of violence in the region. We're joined right now by Dita Sari. She's with the National Front for Indonesian Workers' Struggle, organizer of a conference right now in Jakarta called the Jakarta International Peace Conference. Prothap Chatterjee, independent reporter, also joins us on the line. Dita Sari, we'll start with you. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Can you start off by talking about what you know is happening in Aceh?
Yeah. Since 2 weeks ago, the government has deployed more than 25,000 additional troops to Aceh and 14 warships surrounding Aceh since 2 weeks ago. And even that happens before the Tokyo negotiations started. And a few days before the negotiations started, they arrested five of the negotiators from the Free Aceh Movement side. We now know that the negotiation has failed. No wonder it has failed. And then last night at 12 o'clock, in the middle of the night, the government declared a martial law implemented in Aceh for 6 months and could be extended after that if it is necessary. And the first thing in the morning, there is a news coming from Aceh that three villages in the area of Biren has been bombed from the air by helicopters, and it caused around 25 local people died or and injured. Yeah.
Prothap Chatterjee, you've been following Aceh as well in Jakarta now, which is quite far away from there, but for the peace conference. The latest news that you've heard, also your specialty has always been reporting on oil and gas issues. Aceh, certainly a region, one of the richest in gas, the largest gas field in the world operated by ExxonMobil.
This is ExxonMobil. Mobil is already surrounded by the Indonesian army, and they want to make sure that the Free Aceh Movement could not get any access to the ExxonMobil, could not have a conquer or to the ExxonMobil. And that is the first thing that the Indonesian military would have to make would have to be sure of. So I think the military operation in Aceh also has a task to keep on the Exxon company to be safe. It is on the hands of the Indonesian army.
Prothap Chatterjee, would you like to add to that?
Amy, 11% of Indonesia's income comes from these operations in Aceh, but the amount of money that goes back to the people there amounts to 0.035%. So this is a situation that has repeated itself throughout Indonesia. I was several years ago in West Papua in Irian Jaya, where Freeport McMoRan, a company from Louisiana, is digging for gold, and they've been paying money back in taxes to the Indonesian government and paying for the military, and this is exactly the situation that's repeating itself in terms of the human rights abuses in return for the natural resources that again get shipped out of the country to the United States and to Europe.
Prothap, can you tell us about the peace conference that is taking place now, quite ironically at the time of this massive attack on Aceh?
The reason the conference is happening, and Vita can probably explain more about this, is partly a report back that Vita and a number of other human rights activists from here in Asia, from Thailand, from the Philippines, from Pakistan, and Indonesia, traveled to Iraq just before the bombing began. In fact, they left, I think, on March 19th. And now they're seeking to widen that experience and to bring together global peace movements from around the world, in particular with the focus on the Global South, an organization that Walden Bello heads in the Philippines. And it's really kind of an amazing conference, and I'm deeply grateful that Dita Sari and the folks here in Indonesia, a mostly Muslim nation, have pulled off in bringing together people from the Middle East together with organizers from Europe and North America. There are people here from Lebanon, there are people here from Iraq, from Afghanistan, people from Pakistan, people from the Philippines, Indonesia, all around the region, as well as people from South Africa and Brazil, and of course from Europe and North America.
We're talking to Prothap Chatterjee, who's just traveled to Jakarta for an independent peace conference taking place there. This in the world's largest Muslim country. Also speaking on the line with Dita Sari of the National Front for Indonesian Workers' Struggle. She is well known over the years for fighting against and making the world aware of sweatshops. We are trying to get her back on the line, Prothap, but maybe you can give us a little of that history as well, and Indonesia's role as a place for companies like Nike.
Hello.
Yes, Prothap.
I'm sorry.
Prothap, if you could comment on that.
I missed that, Amy. Sorry. You have to repeat the question.
I was just saying we're trying to get Dita back on the line, but if you could comment on her role as an anti-sweatshop activist, most known for.
The relevance of this conference, I mean, is tremendous in a sense. As somebody who's worked in the environmental and anti-globalization movement for, you know, many, many years, it's very rare that an opportunity has come for people to get together, especially with movements in the Middle East. And I think there's a lot of work to be done, and this is really kind of a first step in the sense that the representatives from Iraq who were speaking just about 2 hours ago were saying that they were somewhat mistrustful and not sure of the anti-globalization forces, but they were willing to learn and to work with them. But they felt that, you know, they had failed to stop the war. And so they really wanted to figure out what to do next, because people, you know, in Syria or North Korea, there are groups here also from South Korea, not unfortunately from North Korea. And really, in creating these bridges between communities and activists, it's really kind of an incredible meeting, because you have the ex-head of the Indian Navy is here. He's now a dedicated peace activist. And you have parliamentarians from the Philippines. You have a human rights commissioner from Thailand. And really, they're trying to figure out what needs to happen next. And it's really something that is there's a few of us here from the north, from North America. There's 5 people from North America among 100 people. Half of the people are from Indonesia. It's really an effort that's been led by communities in Indonesia and the Philippines to try and figure out what needs to happen next for global peace movements. And what's great is it's actually happening from the south as opposed to from us in the north.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Prothap Chatterjee, independent journalist right now in Jakarta at the Conference for Peace in the capital of Indonesia. Again, this as the Indonesian military has launched a massive assault on Aceh. Before that, Dita Sari with the National Front for Indonesian Workers Struggle has just returned from Iraq. One of the organizers of this conference, well known for her anti-sweatshop work, she won a Reebok Human Rights Award for which young activists around the world are awarded tens of thousands of dollars. She refused to accept the award given Reebok's track record in Indonesia. And we're going to turn after our break to a local story in this country. And it's a story, though, that could have international repercussions. And that is the rules around media concentration. We're going to talk about the FCC and Michael Powell. Stay with us.
Self-determination day. Living life in our own way. Breathing freedom, children play. Self-determination day. Bukan rahsia. Celebrating the independence.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. That was Self-Determination by Aloz. The Federal Communications Commission Chair Michael Powell is refusing to delay an upcoming vote on media ownership rules. Democratic FCC commissioners Michael Copps and Jonathan Adelstein had requested a delay so they could evaluate the impact of the rules and reach a possible compromise. But Powell said last week he would not grant the request because it is not backed by the majority of the FCC, not backed by the majority of the five commissioners. Powell is the son of Secretary of State General Colin Powell. So now the FCC will vote on the rules on June 2nd. The rules have not been made public. Powell also refused the dissident commissioners' request to release the rules so they could debate them. Still, some things are known about the upcoming vote. Under the expected changes, for the first time ever, broadcasters will be allowed to own television stations that reach more than 35% of a community. Companies will be allowed to own a newspaper and broadcast outlet in the same market, and the four largest TV networks will be free to merge together. That means that a single CEO could theoretically own all the largest media outlets in the country. Analysts say if the revised rules are passed, the U.S. will see a wave of media mergers and consolidation that is unprecedented in U.S. history. Major media conglomerates such as AOL, Time Warner, General Electric, Disney, and Viacom, and Rupert Murdoch's News Corp are all lobbying for the changes. Media activists have organized a series of public hearings on the issue. In January, trade unions and activists held a public hearing in New York. FCC Chair Michael Powell did not plan to attend that meeting, but relented after getting severely questioned by the Senate and pressure in the public mounting. Powell and other Republican commissioners have boycotted most other public hearings. The next one is this Wednesday in Atlanta. Democracy Now! Will be there. We're joined right now in the studio by Sita Pena Gangadharan. She's a media activist who's been working on FCC deregulation issues since the 1996 passage of the Telecommunications Act. And Juan Gonzalez joins us, co-host of Democracy Now! He's on the phone today. He's also president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, the first journalistic organization to make a statement against the current plans for further deregulation of the media. Sita, let's begin with you. Can you tell us where it all stands right now and what Michael Powell, how much you know about what Michael Powell is proposing?
Well, we don't know a whole lot because they've been really tight-lipped at the FCC and concerned with, you know, any type of public backlash that might happen if they were to release the revisions of the regulations. Right now, we know that the story is, the outcome of this is really grim, that, you know, they are going to raise the national cap from 35% to 45%. They are permitting...
And explain what that means.
That means that... the audience share nationwide. Let's see if I can. It's a complicated issue, and there are a lot of regulations on the table right now. But it means that CBS, Viacom can reach more than 35% of the households in the United States with their programming. So it means that, you know, these big media companies are really trying to create a monopoly and
they can
dominate
own
the
more than 35% of
That's
the market.
Correct.
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
There are five other regulations that are on the table. The newspaper broadcast cross-ownership rule, which was instituted in 1975, the limit on local radio ownership, radio TV cross-ownership, and dual network television network, which you said would essentially mean that ABC and NBC could merge. These are all part of broadcast regulation in the United States. After the 1996 Telecommunications Act, there was a little tiny clause included in the 300-page document that said every 2 years we're going to have to review these rules, the broadcast regulation rules, to see if they are still in the public interest. Now, what's happened is the FCC under Republican leadership, as well as the major media, have decided, well, we're kind of going to gang up and throw these rules out the window and really not pay attention whatsoever to media activists, to journalists, to trade unionists, to educators, people that are vocally opposed to rollback.
Juan Gonzalez on the line with us, president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, in addition to being co-host of Democracy Now! Juan, can you talk about the level of organizing that's going on in journalists' organizations right now, a history of that?
Amy, for the when Powell first announced these proposed rule changes or in September, there was very little being said at the time by journalist organizations or by anyone, or very little coverage by the mass media. In fact, the first real network coverage of this event only occurred last week. Finally, ABC had a segment on it on their nightly news. But until that time, there'd been basically a total blackout by the media, the major media, except for business stories in a lot of the newspapers. In some newspapers, but on the part of journalism organizations, they were all virtually silent. Then in February, our group, the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, a little earlier in January, we filed comments with the FCC, raising questions about the direction it was taking. So we filed official comments with the agency. And then in February, we called on the other journalism organizations in the country to take a stand on an issue that for us, for those of us who work in journalism and understand the enormous impact that these media concentrations have had over the last decade or more on our ability to provide quality programming and comprehensive news and information to the American people, we called on the journalism organizations to stop standing on the sidelines and become vocal. So we asked for Michael Powell and the FCC to hold more official hearings around the country. He's only held one official hearing on the most comprehensive reorganization of media media ownership since the creation of the FCC, and there's only been one hearing in Richmond, Virginia. We call for more hearings and a delay to give more time for the public to become aware of these things. We also called on journalism organizations to take a stand on this issue, and we called on the media organizations that we work for to report about this. So since then, we've been joined by the California Chicano News Media Association, by the National Association of Black Journalists, by the Unity Journalists of Color, by the National Lesbian and Gay Journalism Association, and then just last week, one of the oldest journalism organizations in the country, the Society of Professional Journalists, also joined our call. And so now there's at least half a dozen journalism organizations, all of whom are saying the same thing. The public needs more time. There was a recent poll done by the Pew Center across the country that showed that 72% of the American people don't even know this is happening. They have no idea that the Bush administration is about to totally rewrite media ownership rules in this country. And so that we call basically for more public information and more public output. Now, even with the little knowledge that has occurred, the FCC has been flooded by individual citizens because shows like Democracy Now! and others have other progressive groups have continued to cover this. So they've been flooded with thousands and thousands of filings. And according to Commissioner Copps, who spoke to a group of the board of directors of Unity Journalists of Color just a couple of weeks ago, 90% or more of the filings are all opposed to the current direction that Michael Powell is taking toward deregulation. But despite that, the commission is proceeding. And interestingly, one of the things that I think people don't understand totally is not just the question of the individual rules being the bans being lifted or restrictions expanded, but it's also the synergistic effect of these. For instance, if the ban on newspapers owning television stations in the same city is lifted, and that it seems most likely that will happen, at the same time that another limitation which has existed for years now, which is called the duopoly rule, where one company can own two television stations in the same city, that's being proposed to be lifted to allowing a station to own three, a company to own three television stations. So if both rules are lifted at the same time, it will technically be possible for a newspaper to buy a television station and for that combined company to then buy two more television stations. And at the same time, with the cross-ownership in radio being removed, that combination could then buy up to eight radio stations in the same city. So you could have one company owning the only newspaper in the town, three television stations, and eight radio stations, all one company that would become by far the dominant company in any major city. And believe me, that is a dream that quite a few of the CEOs of many of the major media companies in the United States are having right now.
Juan Gonzalez, President of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. Sita Peña Gangadaran, you co-founded the Center for International Media Action. Juan just mentioned progressive groups organizing, but it's not just progressive groups. Can you talk about the National Rifle Association?
The National Rifle Association just came out, I think it was last week, with an announcement. They had been organizing their membership to write in to their legislators saying that we are opposed to media deregulation. They cited a case in 1992, I think it was following the Gulf War. They tried to air a PSA on ABC, NBC, CBS, and Fox that praised the our army for going in and doing a good job. They said in their letter that they made no mention of firearms, and yet none of the networks agreed to broadcast this PSA. And they said, you know, I mean, it's really interesting because if you look at what they wrote, it almost could be a progressive organization saying the same thing. That is, you know, free speech is imperiled by these rollbacks, by consolidation, and we're in for more if this, in effect, passes. So the National Rifle Association is one of several conservative groups. I think Families in Focus, some of the anti-porn kind of amongst other things, religious right groups have come out and said the same thing, that we are, as constituency groups, threatened by a consolidated media environment. We'll have less of an opportunity to get our message across, to dialogue with reporters, to actually, you know, have news on the air. Mm.
You also have senators who are weighing in, from Trent Lott to Barbara Boxer. A group of frustrated senators, reading from the Denver Post, on Tuesday denounced an FCC plan that would loosen restrictions that prohibit media companies from controlling multiple sources of news and entertainment, a proposal likely to proceed despite some lawmakers' objections. During a contentious Senate hearing on media ownership, a majority of the senators there expressed concern about parts of the proposal and the way the consolidation issue is being handled by the commission. A few senators suggested hauling in FCC members and forcing the commissioners to explain how and why they intend to change media ownership rules. Among the issues the lawmakers raised were whether ownership of local stations by large media companies limits access and community involvement in news coverage, narrows programming choices, raises advertising rates, and lessens the media's appetite for watchdog journalism.
Amy, if I can add on this issue of the broad nature of the opposition. See, I think what is happening here is that obviously these major media companies have an enormous interest in creating size and scale and volume as a means of lowering their costs and bringing out maximum profit. The problem is that there's a fundamental contradiction between their need and the need of the American people for good local news. There have been all kinds of documented reports recently that show that to the degree that national networks and national companies, whether it's in newspaper chains or television or radio, begin to grab hold of local television stations and newspapers, they begin to pay less attention to the local needs of those communities, either in covering local political races, a local assembly races, state senate, or congressional races, in the degree of their emphasis on local news and programming. So because this is such a large country, the United States is not like France or England, where basically most of the media is concentrated in one city and then that begins to radiate out throughout the whole country. This is such a large country that has always depended on local sources of information in the different states. What you're seeing when you see people like Olympia Snow, for instance, or Trent Lott, or some of these other folks who are coming forth, Republicans, these are people from small states who understand that California and New York and a few other places, Chicago, dominate the media landscape and then never allow for sufficient coverage of what is occurring in their local areas. And they often feel, whether the Democrats or Republicans, that they are mischaracterized, ignored, or not covered, and that their interests or their localities are not covered. So really, this is an issue that cuts across political spectrums, but it deals with very much as the NAFTA issue did almost a decade ago, when you had extreme conservatives like Pat Buchanan and Ross Perot and others opposing NAFTA at the same time that you had progressives in the labor movement opposing NAFTA, because it cut to the very heart of the interests of Americans in their local communities to have adequate information to be presented to them from a multiplicity of sources that are not all owned by the same person. Because when the guy at the top owns multiples of channels, even though on small issues those channels may air different views, when it comes to the very big issues that those owners are concerned about, you can bet they're all going to be playing the same tune.
I want to talk about some direct action or protests that have been taking place. Wednesday, Jonathan Adelstein is holding a hearing in Atlanta, Georgia. I'll be there, as Juan was there at the Columbia Law School Forum that was called by Michael Copps, another of the dissident commissioners. Sita, can you talk about how you are organizing at the grassroots level?
There have been something like 8, I believe, hearings nationwide. And in all of those 8 hearings, there have been lead organizations or organizers bringing together people, making sure that there are educators in the room, there are activists in the room, there are journalists in the room, there are people in the room that have a story to tell about how they've been bilked by a conglomerate media. And there have also been direct actions. Just this past Thursday, Code Pink, which is an organization of women for peace, stormed the open public agenda meeting at the FCC, holding up pink slips saying, you know, we want to give pink slips to the Republican commissioners.
Actual pink slips
to the Republican commissioners, decrying the process that they've put in place for reviewing these media ownership rules. Also, on the 10th of May, Prometheus Radio Media Tank, the Philadelphia Regional Anti-War Network organized a group of 300 to march down City Line Avenue to downtown Philly to the offices of Clear Channel ABC and NBC to protest the war coverage that had been going on and that continues to squeeze out any form of dissent and critical coverage about things going on in Iraq. So you will see 2 additional hearings happening in the next 2 weeks, that is, in Atlanta and also in Boston. It's a tremendous show of support from the organizing community. Finally, I think that people are beginning to understand this issue. And, you know, in effect, it's not that difficult, as Juan was talking about. It's an issue that has broad kind of cross-party support. And, you know, if people are asked a question, what do you think of the media system today? They know what's going on. It's Clear Channel, you know.
And yet, Juan, when we were at the Columbia Law School Forum, that was the it wasn't exactly a public hearing, but the forum that was called by the dissident commissioner Michael Copps, and Powell was forced to attend because of how much media interest there was in this, a public interest, and he had just been skewered by senators at a hearing a few days before. There was almost no coverage of that hearing. Can you talk about the lack of coverage by the mainstream media of this issue, though they are weighing in with briefs in support of the deregulation?
Right. Well, I think that, as I said, ABC finally did something this past week. I guess at the network level, only PBS, Bill Moyers, has done several pieces on his show now, but other than that, there has been no sort of on the big networks. The ABC story last week was the first one, and this is very similar to what happened with NAFTA and what happened with the original Telecommunications Act in 1996, which is that when the forces in corporate America have a deep interest in getting legislation passed, suddenly there is very little coverage of it until after. You'll see huge coverage on it as soon as it passes, as soon as the rules are changed. But until then, they want to keep out the public's participation in it. And I think that one of the things that they've been surprised by, because Michael Powell intended...
We only have 10 seconds.
Michael Powell wanted to do this in April. It's now into June. He's been delayed by the public opposition.
Huh. Finally, if people want to find out more information, Sita, where can they go on the web?
There are a variety of sites. One is reclaimthemedia.org. That's www.reclaimthemedia.org, and also mediatank.org.
Well, Sita Peña Gangadaran with the Center for International Media Action, and Juan Gonzalez, president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. Thanks very much for being with us. When we come back, we're going to hear a speech from the last hearing, first held in California, by one of the dissident commissioners. Stay with us.
All right, we're going to fix that technical problem.
Tick-tock, it's time for a shock. Are you bored? It's time to get awed.
ABC, NBC,
CBS, CNN,
Fox News, breaking news,
faking news, the media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
How to keep your sanity while keeping up with the war.
I work
worked at ABC News, worked at CNN. To see so many people, colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration, and unconscious of the effect they're having.
Thank you, sir.
There was never a question raised in the mainstream media about why we should really be going to war, only when we were going to go to war.
The Pentagon also controls the timing of bad news.
Danny Schechter's Media Wars here on Democracy Now! As we turn now to Jonathan Edelstein, one of the five commissioners of the FCC, former staffer for Senator Tom Daschle, has been holding and attending public forums around the country on the public views of the Federal Communications Commission media ownership rules. Jonathan Edelstein.
The FCC is about to make historic changes to our media ownership rules, and that will affect each of you and each of us as media viewers and listeners. These current rules that we have in place that we're about to change are designed to prevent individual companies from gaining too much control over what we see, hear, and read. The public, and that's all of you, own the airwaves. We at the FCC are responsible for overseeing the airwaves in your interest, not in the interest of corporations that profit by using them. That's not just the moral thing to do, that's the law. And that's the law that I'm sworn to uphold. And I'm afraid that we're about to forget that. And we're here to remember that, to remember who we serve. If we make the tragic mistake of allowing too much further media consolidation, we won't be able to undo it. Once companies merge, the FCC never asks them to unmerge. You just can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. The FCC could unalterably change the face of the American media for generations to come. This proceeding is so big, it feels like we're going straight to the Super Bowl without even having begun the regular season. The current FCC media ownership rules are grounded in three basic public policy goals: competition, localism, and diversity. They now make it difficult for one company to own both a newspaper and a television station serving the same community. They also cap the number of television or radio stations that one owner can control in a single area, as well as the number of television stations that one company can own nationwide. Another rule bars the four major TV broadcast networks from merging with one another. All of these rules are now up for grabs. The decisions we will soon make will have profound implications for our culture and for our society and for the politics and the level of civil discourse in this country. It'll affect the diversity of voices that are heard in this country in each of our communities, including the Bay Area. I think it's really sad that most Americans have heard nothing at all about the potential rule changes that we're about to make. I hope we can change that, and that's why I'm here today. But it's almost too late. The RFCC chairman, my chairman, Michael Powell, has vowed that nothing will stop the agency from overhauling these rules by June 2nd. That's about 37 days away. He even dismissed the recent congressional request for more information and more time. Earlier this month, a bipartisan group of 15 senators, including your very own Barbara Boxer, members of the Commerce Committee, asked the chairman to hold off on any changes until the FCC discloses more detail about its proposed rules so that Congress and the public can have the opportunity to respond. A similar letter followed from the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, which is concerned about protecting and promoting minority ownership in the media, as well as the impact of media consolidation on the Latino community. What was the chairman's response? He cast aside these congressional requests, announcing he's going to go forward full steam ahead despite these mounting concerns. So June 2nd is going to be a defining moment in the American media consolidation, in the history of American media consolidation. This issue is as important as any other one that the country faces right now, apart from war and peace. But guess what? The network media aren't even covering it. Some of you who watch public television might have seen last night that Bill Moyer is on Now, ran a program on this where he interviewed Barry Diller, who said he's extremely concerned about the direction that this is taking. This is somebody who's been one of the most successful broadcasters in the history of American journalism, and the networks won't put him on, but thank God for public broadcasting. Well, it's critical that we hear from the public before June 2nd. But to comment on the issues that are at stake, you, the American public, and your representatives in Congress need more information. There's rumors swirling all around the Capitol about the so-called diversity index and other approaches the FCC could take to overhaul these rules. But given that June 2nd is just 37 days away, A lot of people are understandably bewildered about what framework they'll face on June 3rd. Since we're charged with serving the public interest, the FCC should never be afraid of public comment. It only strengthens the ultimate product. It could help us avert unintended consequences. Perhaps most importantly, comment on a new plan is required by the law, as the Office of Advocacy of the U.S. Small Business Administration recently alerted our chairman. Now, Chairman Powell stated that the public has had every opportunity to respond to the notice that the FCC sent out last year, last September. The problem is that now we're crafting a whole new proposal, and the public has never had an opportunity to see it or to comment on any of the specifics. On an issue of this magnitude, the FCC has a legal and a moral obligation to provide the public with more specific information before sealing their fate into federal regulations. That's why, as a backstop, I recently asked the chairman, alert the public at least to the broad outlines of the plan in an open forum or a speech or something. Let them know the details. I even suggested let's do the public briefing in the context of the June 2nd timeframe that you have, even though I don't think that's the best timeframe. I think it's a rush to judgment. Something like this, which would fall short of the Administrative Procedure Act's full notice and comment procedures, would still go a long way to helping the public understand what's happening within the confined walls of the FCC. But he rejected that proposal as well, along with the others. And that's a sad, sad state of affairs, because the stakes in this proceeding couldn't be higher. The mass media shapes our thoughts, our decisions, and our values more than we might imagine, and perhaps more than they should. But given that reality, since our media ownership rules were first established, Americans have more forms of media than ever, and that's what those who argue that we can allow more consolidation say. But I question, does the availability of a greater number of channels necessarily translate into a greater number of diverse voices for accessing local news and information? I'm not so sure it does. I think our local communities are better served by hearing many voices discussing the issues of the day on a number of outlets, rather than just a handful of giant voices booming loudly across the range of media outlets that they own and control. Diverse views fuel our public debate, and they strengthen our democracy. We need more voices in the nation's media, but not just from one ventriloquist. Now, a big issue before us is allowing a single company to own a variety of different media outlets, which is currently addressed by what we call our cross-ownership rules that we'll be hearing more about today. If the FCC jettisons these rules, what would we put in its place? I happen to believe that you could put something in its place. You could draft a properly crafted framework for assessing viewership across media in a particular local market, and that could serve as a proxy for the cross-ownership rules. But any gauge of diversity that the FCC employs has got to recognize the singular importance of media in the civic discourse and protect against too much concentration, given that fact. Because the media isn't like other consumer goods. Unlike cereal or ketchup, mass media has viewpoints attached to it. Control of the media affects the vibrancy of what the Supreme Court has called the, quote, uninhibited marketplace of ideas, unquote. It affects the very health of our democracy. Supreme Court has said, as a result of that, that the FCC may not abridge the right of Americans to have access to ideas and to creativity. Critics say that loosening the media ownership rules will unleash media giants to intensify their grip on the news business, drive local voices off the air, and block a variety of political viewpoints from reaching the airwaves. And the other side argues that consolidation can have positive effects, such as economies of scale. But our job is to protect the public, not corporations that naturally seek efficiencies. And what about the risks on the other side, especially the risk of losing what we call localism? Because television and radio stations in the U.S. are licensed to serve individual communities, both as outlets for local expression and local artists, and as sources of local news and information. The public deserves, and the laws require, programming that serves the unique needs of local communities. We've never given out national licenses in this country. We give them out to local communities. Consolidation, on the other hand, often leads to the homogenization of programming that so many people that I've spoken to at hearings like this across the country have said that they're fed up with. Evidence shows that television and newspapers are by far the most important sources of local news and public affairs information. Newspaper magnate William Randolph Hearst understood the key power of local news outlets. I know you here in the Bay Area know a little something about Mr. Hearst and the power of local media. When asked why he preferred concentrating on newspapers with their limited regional appeal rather than spending more energy on motion pictures and their worldwide audience, he pithily replied, "I thought of it, but I decided against it. Because you can crush a man with journalism, but you can't with motion pictures." Now, we may be on the verge of creating a 21st century Citizen Kane, or maybe a handful of them. I've heard the arguments made by those seeking to abolish the newspaper television cross-ownership rule that common ownership is needed for newspaper companies to stay afloat or to produce better quality news, and sometimes that may be the case. But we've got to question whether mergers are the only ways that you can accomplish this. If efficiencies are gained by merging a newspaper with a TV station, couldn't we get the same benefits from a joint news gathering agreement between the two entities? That arrangement could at least preserve separate ownership and separate editorial managerial control, which would help to ensure diverse viewpoints. We should decide if some of the claimed efficiencies can be gained short of an outright merger. Now, even assuming that newspapers are cash-strapped, which we hear from them, and I think it's debatable, what does that tell us? To me, it means there's a slim hope that we're going to see any new newspapers created in this country. So that means we better tread real carefully with the ownership of the few precious daily newspapers that still exist. Now, if you don't think changes in these rules can affect you, tune into today's radio. In 96, Congress, not the FCC, relaxed the rules that govern who can own radio stations in this country, and that prompted an unprecedented wave of consolidation in the radio business. In the first year after the act passed, more than 2,100 of the approximately 11,000 radio stations in this country changed hands. And most of these stations were sold to companies that already own stations, many of them former competitors in exactly the same markets. Radio conglomerates now centralize, broadcasting from remote headquarters and pump homogenized playlists into stations around the country. The largest radio group owns 1,240 stations, up from 40 before the rule change. There's a town in North Dakota from my neck of the woods called Minot that felt the effects of this recently. When a train carrying ammonia derailed and released a noxious cloud of gas, police sought to alert the community to steer clear. So they called the local radio stations, all six of which were owned by Clear Channel Communications. But the company had pared down its local operations and nobody was there to pick up the phone. 300 people were hospitalized. For that community, loss of localism really resulted in tangible and devastating consequences. Now, I've compared the experience of the radio industry to the canary in the coal mine. Miners would send a canary down there first to make sure that it was safe before they entered. We better examine the health of this canary real carefully before we take any steps that might lead to consolidation in other media outlets like TV, cable, and newspapers. And what's the rush to make major changes now? The FCC should focus on putting in place a workable structure, one that survives scrutiny by the courts, as the chairman has said he wants to do, and then over time adjust the levels for greater amounts of consolidation after we've proven that the initial steps didn't hurt the public. The law provides a structure for the FCC to review these rules every 2 years. Why not focus now on implementing a workable structure, and then work towards loosening in years to come as we learn more about the implications of greater consolidation on localism and on diversity and on the public? The FCC should proceed with a lot of caution in this area, because our rules are designed to prevent a Citizen Kane-like figure from amassing way too much control over the media and over what we see, hear, and read, and over the civic discourse. But caution and speed don't mix well in any context, particularly not when the safeguards of our democracy are at stake. So as we proceed at lightning speed now towards June 2nd, I hope that Chairman Powell will provide the public with an inkling of what's to come, so that we can debate the effect of any concrete proposals he discloses. That's what the public rulemaking proceeding should be all about. Each of you here today should be a part of that dialogue, and you are a part of that dialogue by being here and participating. I can't emphasize enough the importance of your participation, because if we're going to craft media ownership rules that best serve the public interest, we sure better hear from the public, and that's why I'm here to listen from you. So let's go to it and begin the discussion. Thank you all for being here this morning.
And that was Jonathan Edelstein, one of the 2 of 5 dissident commissioners on the FCC. That does it for the program. Our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.